It's Legal Defense with Kirk Hobert on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. How you doing, John?
I'm great, Kirk. How are you?
I'm very well.
All right. All right. I know you were a little... go ahead.
What's that? You heard I was a little sick? Is that what you're
going to
say?
Yeah, a little sick.
I'm better.
But you're better. Good. Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
It happens.
Like in Forrest Gump. It happens.
It happens.
But anyway, I wanted to talk about a particular topic.
Yeah, you got some things on your mind today.
I do. And this comes from a variety of sources, a lot of which are... emanate from listener feedback. And, you know, one thing that people really struggle with often, especially when we're dealing with the justice system and how allegations of crime work and then the adjudication process and so on, it's all part of a public forum. And that's by design. You've heard the old saying, the best antiseptic is sunlight, meaning that when things don't happen behind closed doors, there aren't shady deals on a handshake and a bribe, you know, that the public can examine everything that happens in order to keep people honest, keep things fair. As we know from some revelations that have occurred somewhat recently, that it doesn't always happen when you're talking about things that people in the government do. But ideally, you know, if people know that their decisions can be examined and that the rationale for what happened or how it happened is open to view, then it's one of those methods of keeping our government from becoming corrupt. But that's a great idea when you're talking about, you know, the courthouse in 1790 in, you know, Philadelphia or something like that.
Well, you're referring to just charging decisions, writ large.
Yeah,
just to be clear.
Primarily. And you know, I'm sure we can all imagine if someone was charged with high treason by, you know, saying something that they shouldn't have said or, you know, starting a riot or something like that, like a lot of the criminal charges that we were sorting through in the early days of our government. You know, those are the kinds of things where you'd proudly walk into court to have yourself vindicated and stroll around town, you know, carrying your cane and being proud of the fact that you were acquitted. You'd want a public exoneration in that sense. But I don't think people think about justice the same way anymore, because the way society has evolved, a lot of people have come to the conclusion that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. In other words, they wouldn't have been charged.
Wouldn't have been arrested if he didn't do something.
Well,
you know, police don't
that's far from the truth. But
the police just don't arrest innocent people. They just don't, you know. Come on.
Yeah,
you know that.
People don't understand necessarily the dynamics of how someone becomes charged, but I'm sure most people imagine that there's some kind of, you know, order to it and that somebody looks at evidence and somebody makes a decision and then it results in somebody, you know, the defendant being placed into custody, bonded out, whatever, criminal charges proceeding, goes in front of a judge. And I think we all like to hope that there's some kind of rational connection to evidence. The reality is, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but our listeners might not know this, you know, on any typical weekend, this weekend, for example, I'm sure, as there is every weekend, a number of people are picked up starting, you know, Friday night through Saturday, Sunday, etc. You know, during the Packer game, there's probably
a very popular
incident
one
of some sort. Yeah, it's always a popular one. And then, you know, people are basically put into custody. And then Monday morning, whatever assistant district attorney is on duty has to sift through these police reports, and there might be dozens of them. And they have to make a pretty quick charging decision based upon limited information. Now, this is another competing set of variables here that, you know, it's just the reality of the situation. On the one hand, we'd like to think that prosecutors give it some thought and give it some, you know, some deliberation prior to making a decision that could affect someone's life forever, whether they're guilty or not. It still is a pretty big thing to be charged with a crime. On the other hand, someone is potentially sitting in custody and needs to await a hearing before it can be determined what charges will be and what the bond conditions will be. So, you know, on the one hand, they need to do it quickly for the sake of the defendant. On the other hand, they need to do it, you know, carefully. So it's
well,
not,
you know,
a rush.
It's a dilemma, and you're right. I mean, it kind of depends on the county you're in, and it also depends on the human beings that are manning the desk, as it were, because some people just take their sometimes very strident worldviews / political views into their charging decision job, and that's a problem. You know, they don't even make a pretense, some people, about trying to be objective or trying to,
let me tell you, you're right.
Go ahead.
Let me tell you another problem that just arises in this context that, and again, this isn't the fault necessarily of any particular prosecutor. It's just something that happens by human nature and because of the way the processes work. You know, imagine a prosecutor that says, okay, I've got limited information. I'm going to charge this person with a low-level misdemeanor. Then as they fully develop the evidence, they realize that it should be a serious felony. Well, you know, going up from a low position on the ladder is more difficult than going down from a high position on the ladder, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So what they can, if they say, I'm going to charge them with first-degree murder with the intent that they'll probably, when they have more time, dispense with this as a disorderly conduct, something like that. You know? that's a little rare, but you know what I mean. Just the way the system works, it's easier to back off of a charge than it is to ramp one up. So I think psychologically there's a tendency to charge as much as you can. Not only that, but there is guidance from the Department of Justice that's given out to both police officers as well as prosecutors that if a crime fits, charge it. So it's really a matter of plugging in the elements and seeing if you
can
make it fit.
This reminds me of under the George W. Bush administration, who was the attorney general? Who was that? John Ashcroft. So yes. Ashcroft, if you remember this, I'm sure you do, this is right on point with what you're talking about. He issued a memo saying to all U.S. attorneys across the country that not only do you have to charge it, you have to charge the highest possible crime that you can charge for the highest possible penalty.
Correct. And you know, that doesn't come from a law and order mentality. I think that comes more from a let's respect the legislative mandate. You know, if the legislature says this is what they want to have happen as a result of a particular criminal act, the process is somewhat breaking down if the prosecutors don't implement it, I think, is the philosophy. Now, the reality is far from that because every case is different. And although legislators like to think that every single case of a particular flavor is the same, there never are.
I think you talk to any prosecutor, and they want to have some flexibility. They don't want to be bound. Like for example, there's all sorts of examples of like this in various district attorneys' offices around the state where they have absolute guidelines, almost orders saying this is what we have to do on all OWI cases, for example, or on all those Romeo and Juliet cases, what other fill in the blank example, you know, and there's very little flexibility really, and unfortunately for a lot of these decision makers on the front lines, and that's a problem, I think.
So let's apply this to the bigger picture, which is my point about open government. If we're, and I think that we can all agree that that's a noble concept. You know, having an open system is far better than having a closed one.
Well, it's democratic. You know, big D. You know, the whole philosophy of our system.
So here's my dilemma, and it's just something where I have
Spill
mixed
it.
Views on it. On behalf of my clients who I'm representing, I would prefer that they not go through the anguish of being charged with something that they ultimately don't end up convicted of, or the charge is amended, or if the person's acquitted, or it's dismissed, or whatever ends up happening. As soon as that charge hits the public forum, they are viewed, you know, with the mind's eye towards discrimination, I guess. You know, so if somebody is charged with a serious offense, they immediately experience difficulty on all sorts of levels. And part of that is because the public is free to see. So, you know, on a personal level, when I'm dealing with the immediate impact on my clients, I would prefer they didn't have to go through that. On the other hand, I think that if you have examples that other people can point to where you don't fully respect the idea of open government, it gives, you know, people the opportunity to have things closed in other ways. And they say, hey, look, in this situation, we close that information to public view to protect a person, to protect someone's reputation. I mean, think about the ramifications applied in other areas. And if all the things that we really do need to know about how the government operates in order to keep it honest, if we start having exceptions here and there for what appear to be noble reasons, we run the risk of creating precedent for other areas, which is potentially quite dangerous. But
yeah,
we're going to have to take a break.
Oh.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought, because we're going to take a break and then come right back, okay?
Got it.
All right, we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. So, Kirk, you were espousing some
monologue.
Yes, some interesting thoughts about, you know, it's kind of about open government, and I think it's kind of a quandary, you know. It's kind of a coin flip on a lot of these questions that because we all want to have open government because we see what happens when people are too secretive. You know, that's
right.
That's one of the raps on both Clinton and Trump for goodness sake. You know,
exactly.
Is that they're both so sneaky and they're not revealing and they're not disclosing and you know, and I kind of get it from their perspective. Well,
maybe we should have a rule where if someone's charged with a crime, we'll reveal the result after the audit is complete. You know, I don't know.
So you know, it's really a question of discretion. Right, that lovely word that means you get to do whatever you want and there's no consequences.
Yep.
This is the fundamental problem. So prosecutorial discretion is sacrosanct, you know, in our judicial system. It's nobody would ever touch it. They have complete liability from civil suits if they make a wrong.
You mean immunity?
Immunity. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they make a wrong charging decision, somebody gets wrongfully convicted, and you know, and honestly, I've it's pretty rare to ever see a prosecutor apologize for a charging decision,
right.
Even when it's proven that they were wrong.
I covered this on a show, I think about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years, and there was actually a prosecutor that was charged criminally for knowingly contributing to a conviction of a person who was innocent.
Wow, what was that?
You know, and we do have a statute. That was in Connecticut, if I recall correctly. But we do have a statute here in Wisconsin that applies to witnesses. If a witness lies and contributes, and as a result of that lie, a person is convicted of a crime, it's a more serious charge than simple obstruction. I had a client charged with that once. And it was mischarged because the prosecutor didn't read the statute carefully. But, you know, we do have this idea that we want to do all we can to simultaneously convict the guilty and protect the innocent. And juggling all of that in the context of open government, you know, if you really believe that open government is a good idea, and that's really where, you know, a lot of people agree that, you know, just as a pure principle, open government is a good thing. And it's a very broad concept. Now, when you start applying it individually to different sets of circumstances, that's where it gets sticky. But again, as I was saying before the break, if we start creating exceptions to the rule, then we have to worry about how that would be applied in other areas.
And, well, it depends, you know, rule you're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
I think that one thing that we really run into a problem with, and this is something that continues to be debated, but you know what expunction is, or to, it's weird because to expunge is the right way to say it, but expunction is the correct word.
Yeah.
I said expungement for years, but then, you know, when you type it on...
That was the word they used in the statute originally.
Well, I know, but when you type it in on WordPerfect, it says that's spelled wrong. And then when you correct it to expungement,
well, you
got to
stop
like,
using WordPerfect.
That's okay.
That's your problem right there.
Well, that could be.
That's ancient technology.
I get criticized for that all the time. It's like the one program you can't use on a Mac, but anyway, that's another area that... You know, again, I'm split, and this has to do, again, with open government. If we acknowledge the fact that being branded a felon or, let's just say, a criminal at a certain point in a young person's life, who's an adult but not a very old adult, and if the judge makes a finding that the person can benefit and society will not be harmed by more or less rewarding that defendant with having it erased from their record – which is a bit of a misnomer, but, you know, expunction means to, you know, reverse the conviction for legal purposes, yet it doesn't undo the incident, obviously.
Right, And it also does not eliminate the records from the police department or, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, heck, even if you're even if you call your neighbor's loud dog in, you're in the police record. I mean, if you're a witness or a victim or a whatever.
Well, you know,
there's a police record.
Yeah, I think I see where you're drifting with this, though. And this, you know, what this reminds me of is the balance between in a system where the charges are made. Then everything's public and we have this whole procedure. But before the charges are made, before the charging decision is made, there's like this ultra secrecy, right? And they won't give you discovery until a certain point in the process. And they won't, you know, they don't have any legal duty to give you any information because there's a quote unquote, you know, they want to keep the integrity of their investigation and all this. And I guess there's an argument to be made for that. But I know that you have done this too, is that the best work a criminal defense lawyer can do is to have a good relationship with the prosecutors and the police and may have impact before the charging decision is made and get them to give you information that you were not entitled to, but that helps to settle the matter more reasonably.
But that's also fair. The thing I agree with you, and that is one way of being especially effective, but it also is somewhat random because what that requires is the client, the would-be accused, to contact you before the charging decision is made. Now, that happens sometimes.
That is true. That is a problem.
But a lot of the time, I mean, I don't know. I'd say most of the time, I get the call after the person's already been charged.
And by the way, after they've already talked to the police at length.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
It's like, thanks for helping me with my Miranda motion. I really appreciate. let's see if we can unring the bell on this thing. But I don't know.
But getting back to your point about that decision that gets made, and this is, I'm not exaggerating here one iota. I've heard it from the horse's mouth. Prosecutors that say, "Yeah, I know that we charge this more seriously than it's going to end up, but." You always have that chance for expunction at the end, or expungement at the end of the process. So it's like a safety net or an escape valve, you know, safety valve, escape net, whatever.
So they get to look tough. Something. They get to look tough with a more serious charge up front, and then you get to look good because you got it expunged.
Way of putting it. Way of putting it is they're using a method whereby. You know, you hope, number one, that the judge approves it, and number two, that the client doesn't get in trouble during the period of time that they have to stay out of trouble,
that's true.
Even for something very minor. And then you also have to deal with the fact that – and I'm sorry. I mean, this is how I pay my bills. I understand that. But it's also unfair that somebody gets charged with a very serious offense. Then they have to come in and hire me, and then I have to jump through all the hurdles to get this expungement thing to go through. And, you know, it's a lot of work. And unfortunately, the way that it turns out is that the people have to spend a whole lot of money and there's a whole lot of rigmarole. And if that was going to be the desired result to begin with,
why don't we just cut to the chase and go directly there? Yeah, I agree.
But again, if it's something that allows, at least psychologically, a prosecutor to say, okay, you know, I'm going to make this charging decision, but in the back of his or her mind, they know that worst case scenario, it could be expunged from the record. I think it makes it so that the ownership of the responsibility is lessened. You know, the actual taking responsibility for that decision is impacted, because there's always like this, you know, worst case scenario ends up being something that is not their fault. If let's say the client screws up when they're on a deferred conviction agreement. Well, that's not the prosecutor's fault, you know.
Well, this gets back to sort of the individual's handliness in the first place, you know, who are, you know, just human beings, and a lot of them are political animals. A lot of them want to advance their careers. They want to be judges. They want to be the elected DA or whatever it is that their heart desires. And so they come into their job with the attitude that they want to hammer everybody every time, all the time. And you don't see that with
an easy answer. Yeah.
And you generally don't see that with experienced prosecutors. Experienced prosecutors are generally have a very measured approach, and they know what's up, and they know what's serious, and they know what really needs to be addressed, and they're not going to waste their time, you know, grandstanding. That's one of the reasons, just as an aside, that as much as I want the defense function to be funded better, you know, just sort of system wide, I want DAs to be funded better too.
Because I'm with you on that, for sure. Absolutely. Well, all right. Time for another break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. I'm Kirk O'Bear, and you're
John Bertzel. I am. Still.
You know, we're kind of getting into another subject here. You left off with the concept about funding and funding for the defense, as well as funding for the DA's office. And I absolutely agree that, you know, better.
Yeah, I think
most
people do.
Justice is done when there's funds available for both sides. But, you know, it's one of those things that people just aren't willing to spend money on. And we end up in this cyclical argument where if DA's offices are always asking for more money, and usually they're absolutely right that they need more funding,
absolutely.
More positions.
Couldn't agree
but
more.
The problem is, in order to keep it, you know, yes, the public has a quote unquote right to have cases prosecuted by the executive branch of the government, sure, but a more important right is the right that every citizen enjoys as an American to have the Sixth Amendment apply to them properly. That's more important than the public's
right to
prosecute.
And the Fourth and Fifth, for that matter.
Right, and all those. Yeah.
But I mean, if you look at the construction of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, I mean, it doesn't talk about granting powers. It talks about limiting powers. So, but the problem, the funding problem is, and you've been involved in this too, it's just, is that, you know, people, they revert back to their tribes and they try and get the most they can for their tribe. So the defense tribe wants their stuff and the prosecutors want theirs. And of course, you know, they both get play in the newspapers, but the play for the prosecutors is very sympathetic and the play for the defense is not so much. So, I don't know.
And that's the problem. I think that's actually something that the legislators, you know, struggle with, is that when the DA's office says, hey, we need such and such amount of money, they think to themselves, well, okay, but if we do that, you know, you might as well just double it because we're going to get the requests from the defense. And they're, you know, I hate to say it, but and it's not a conspiracy because conspiracy implies that it might not be true. But I think there is a concerted effort to make sure that the defense doesn't get adequate funding. So, you know.
Well, here's the funny thing. I was thinking about this actually driving through a years-long project in 94 coming out of Milwaukee, which is I don't even know what they're trying to do here, but it's been going on for years.
I was just through that area recently, and I was like, what is going on?
It's been going on for years. It's going to go on for more years. And I'm telling you right now, nobody thinks, those legislators think nothing about spending $400, $500, $600 million on a highway project when the entire court system, in Wisconsin composes 0.1% of our state budget.
Yeah.
And so when we ask for more money, we're not asking for a new interchange here. You know, we're not asking
That's a really good point. It's a really good point because I had the same thought when I was driving through that mess of whatever is going on 94. And actually, it was when I was driving back from that conference you and I were both on.
Oh, right.
And my car said, oh, don't go that way. And I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Wait a minute. What do you know that sure I don't know?
My car was smarter than me. And, I ended up in, trying to get from basically Waukesha to downtown Milwaukee to catch 43 to go back up. Oh, my goodness. That was painful.
It's something else.
The thought I had was, at what point did the public become involved or informed about the extent of that project, the amount of money that would be involved? And I mean, talk about something where, $100 million one way or the other could be based upon, someone's whim.
Well,
here we are struggling to get every dime.
That's a really interesting point. Those decisions are made by engineers and somewhat political figures who say, I want a highway here because it's going to help business in my district or whatever the case may be. And you're right. You're absolutely right. Those decisions are very closed door. Those are smoky backroom decisions. And because on some level they're going to say, well, the public doesn't really understand. They don't have the studies about where we need new roads and the demographics coming out in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years or something to look ahead and or maybe to do a big public works project, a new sewer, or like the deep tunnel project, if you remember that. So, but they're right because the public wouldn't understand that or grasp that but at the same time they equally don't grasp the magnitude of the justice system but every legislator in Madison thinks they have a total handle on it because they have this intuitive knowledge in their own little brains about what is just, right?
Yeah.
And mostly they know what sells. Mostly they know what to put in their newsletter back home.
What drives me crazy about some of these big projects? I mean, everybody likes to see the roads improved. The problem is I can't remember a summer where I actually drove someplace without having the hassle of construction. But, on a different wavelength here, the thought I always end up having when I see so much money, and it's needed, of course, but it's because we become so dependent upon the roadways themselves. And it's really like building a statue out of wax, it's going to look nice, but it's predestined that it's going to melt or fall away.
Well, if you're in the construction industry, what a great industry to be in. You get paid an obscene amount of money to make the road in the first place, and it's only going to last 20 years, and you're just going to have to rebuild it.
Yeah, it's going
to
be obsolete. Right. It's like what they
used
to do with
Kirk.
Well, I know. Roofing is a good example because for years and years and years, there was the technology to build roofs, with shingles and other better materials that would last for 50 years, but they wouldn't do it. They would only do 15 years, because they wanted to remain in business. Planned obsolescence the idea.
Sort of our post-war economy, right?
Right, exactly. But if we had the wisdom to, say, for example, accept federal funds to build high-speed rail transit systems. Oh, I heard another interesting comment from a listener. I was at an event earlier this week, not yours, but a different one, where somebody had mentioned their idea about why Wisconsin Governor Walker in particular wanted to turn down the funds that would have gone towards building high-speed rail.
Yeah.
And, I just got to say, when that proposal was out there, I got super excited because it was going to connect Chicago to Milwaukee.
Absolutely.
To Green
I would
Bay.
Have used it like crazy.
Wow.
Because I use the Amtrak to Chicago all the time because.
Well, I do too. And it's really convenient. It's absolutely super convenient. I love going on that Hiawatha thing because there's.
Absolutely.
You know, my biggest fear when I'm going to court in the Seventh Circuit is I'm not going to make it there on time and I don't want to go the night before. So, you know, it's absolutely reliable. You get there exactly when you're supposed to get there. But, you know, so we've become so dependent upon, you know, regular old automobile transportation here and there. But anyway, here was the comment I heard. When you connect the big cities to the more rural areas, apparently there are people that have some push and pull in the more suburban and rural areas that don't want the inner city riffraff coming out to the
brass tacks over here.
So, so like there's this idea that if we open up a direct rail line that goes from Chicago to Green Bay, we're going to end up, you know, with more crime in Green Bay.
It's going to get really dark. It's going to get really dark.
Yeah, exactly.
You've heard that remark before.
Yes, of course. But I mean, that seems a little insidious, but I bet, you know, the real explanation, the official explanation is, you know, Wisconsin doesn't want to be tied to the federal government or beholden. I mean, come on. What do you think all these highway projects are partially being funded by?
Yeah, at least half, if not more, are federal funds.
But, we need to do – you know, people complain about drunk driving. People complain about the arbitrariness of being subject to the possibility of being killed by a drunk driver when you're minding your own business driving down the road. Well, you know what? We spend so much money on making sure that we don't have mass transit that it's just so – it's hypocritical, you know?
I'll tell you, when I – you and I both love going to New York City. And okay, you know, and would you ever think about renting a car there? Of course not.
Never. I never have.
and if you live there, I wouldn't even own a car. I mean, you'd have no need for that whatsoever.
There are literally millions of people in that city that do not have a car.
They probably don't even have driver's licenses.
Right.
Because they don't need them.
Imagine if they had those same voter ID problems that we have here. I mean, you'd be disenfranchising the entire borough of Manhattan, you know?
right. So, you know, speaking of just the touching on New York City here, Donald Trump made a comment about how he wants to bring back, after a series of shootings that just are going to keep happening, he wants to bring back stop and frisk, and praising Mayor Giuliani for, despite the fact it was struck down by a federal judge twice.
Yeah, and despite the fact that it took many decades to educate the public and the judiciary on why it's such a bad idea, and now he just wants to willy-nilly reverse all that progress?
Well, the problem is not that he's some sort of savant that knows what he's talking about. Is that a lot of people are going to buy into that.
I think he may have heard the words stop and frisk in different contexts, but just recently he heard them put together. And he's like, that sounds good.
Wait a minute. That's genius.
All right.
That's
genius. Time for a break. Oh. We'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. And today we're talking about open government. And it's kind of drifted to talking about, you know, Donald Trump.
It's all related.
It is all related, yes. Just sometimes our conversations just kind of drift a little bit, but that's fine.
I got another little tidbit here that you'll find interesting.
Tidbit away.
About open government. As body cams become more used, and I think everyone agrees that's a good thing. Most people do anyway. Most police departments agree that it's a good thing. Occasionally there are some outliers that don't like the idea. We hear an occasional comment that it will hurt the ability for police to do their jobs.
Yeah,
I don't buy that.
Same thing they said about Miranda, the same thing they said you know, any other restriction on whatever they have to do. So, it's, you know, if I was a police officer, I would love to have a body cam.
I know. It protects you.
Absolutely.
Let's assume you're going to make the right choices. Let's assume that you're going to follow the rules. Well, the camera's there to prove it.
I've talked to several officers that were totally in favor for that very reason.
Yeah. And then, you know, better to have something that is mostly or quasi-objective. I mean, at least something visual to back up an officer's version of events rather than imagining what happened, you know, because then there's no – then anything could happen. But anyway, we're seeing decisions come out all over the country that on the issue of whether or not police body camera footage fall within open records laws.
Yeah.
And Iowa had a decision holding that, yes, indeed, these are absolutely, without question, the essence of open records, and that it, since it's showing firsthand how the government works, they should be open for inspection. Now, at the same time, there was another jurisdiction, I believe it was New Jersey, I'd have to double check on that, that came to the opposite conclusion with just as much finality and, yeah, and obviousness. Obviously, these are not open records because et cetera, you know, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we're seeing, again, if the idea is, the idea behind open records is that when the government is operating in however it is doing what it does, the public has a right to know how these things happen so that they're not done behind closed doors. Now, true, a body camera does not reflect the internal workings of the government, and this is where you hear the argument that this isn't a committee meeting. Would we be required to reveal surveillance of the White House if that shows the president the police walking are gonna, down the hallway?
The police have a legitimate argument to say, you know, that at least part of this is an investigatory record, as opposed to
there's that.
But also, it doesn't. Legislative thing.
Yeah, but and remember the real spirit behind open records is that if there are documents that the government maintains that show how deliberative processes and what they really mean is a committee meeting where so and so took a position on an issue and then this other aspect of it was raised and then somebody objected and then somebody took a different position, then you find out that person had a campaign donation from somebody that, you know, those kinds of things. So you can know what is said in these meetings. Now, it reflects, as I said, a deliberative process in people that are part of the government taking particular positions on different issues. Now, it's a little different when you're talking about documentation of something that happens. And surely, I don't mean to call you Shirley, John, but anyway, surely there is...
Taking me back to the movie Airplane right there.
Yes. No, there isn't. And don't call me Shirley.
Don't call me Shirley.
Well, how could I ever forget Macho Grande?
hospital, what is
there
it?
Is well, a it's very a big, good
it's
argument.
A big hospital. It's a big building with sick people.
There's an argument that makes sense that if this is something that shows, you know, how the government is doing what it does. And again, police are part of the government. There's no doubt about that. But what about this? What if there was a request? What if I sent a request that said, I want to know how you are training your SWAT teams to be how they monitor radio communications looking for suspected terrorists, what frequencies they use, you know, what kind of weaponry they have, how big are their tanks that they use. You know, there'd be reasons why they don't necessarily want to tell me that, and it wouldn't necessarily have to do with how the government works or operated. On the other hand, if it's government money that's being spent to buy all this stuff, and if I want to know where my tax dollars are going, that's a legitimate reason to know these things. But, of course, you'll hear, hey, a would-be terrorist or would-be assassin could use that information to accomplish a crime.
Well, something even less dramatic, though, as far as like whether they're going to release something would be, for example, if they recorded, you know, if the recording shows the identity of a sexual assault victim or something else, or if they were going to say, for example, it's a drug thing and a drug conspiracy, you know, controlled by or something like that, and it shows other people that are they're still investigating, you know. And so, you know, I can see them objecting to that, but really I think that's a pretty easy fix. You know, I mean, you and I both know how to edit videos. I mean, we do it all the time. Yeah. You know, because
I hear your point people. And you're right. But here's a problem that I've encountered recently in a case I'm dealing with right now. I was provided recorded footage And there was no indication, documentary or otherwise, that it had been edited. And when there's no indication that it's been edited, you naturally should assume that it's that it's complete.
Uh-oh.
So, you know what I mean? So yeah,
I
not
can
only
see where this is going. Go ahead.
So yes, and I do understand and somewhat agree with the idea that let's look at it this way. There shouldn't be an opportunity for someone to utilize the open records law to perpetrate a crime or to obstruct justice, right? Okay, so let's say they're in the middle of an investigation. They charge one guy, but the other guy's on the run. Somebody requests an open records. They use that information to warn the guy, hey, they're coming after you. This is the guy who is the confidential informant. You know, you can put a hit out on him, all that kind of stuff. That makes sense that they're not going to release that because it's logical. But if you get something that has been edited, now it's easy to tell when it's in a report because they have their big old black pen that they strike stuff through, and you know it's being deleted because you can see it right there. There's a black pen that wrote, you know, that crossed out what you're looking at.
Right,
but
right,
in the
right.
form of video, and this is a big problem because it didn't have a counter. Like sometimes you can tell if the counter skips. Mm. This was like a not quite a body cam, but a surveillance. A surveillance camera that was in a car as part of a supposed drug transaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, not at the dash, but like being in the car documenting what happened inside the car.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah. And they just cut huge portions of it out and didn't tell me. So it comes to light later on. And here's the thing. This gets complicated because for the purposes of me representing my client and investigating the case, I believe I do need to know, not necessarily what was taken out, but the fact that something was taken out.
Well, I've often run into situations that where I'm given tons of video in a drug case, for example, and I only get 2 minutes. Like they only give you
that.
they only give you the 2 minutes where they see your client or whatever. And I'm like, okay, well, I know you were in the car for an hour and I know you were following him for an hour. So I'd like to see it all if that's okay. And of course they're just like, no, that's all we've got. You know, that's what they tell me, but I know it's not true.
And this is, we're entering an era now. I'm absolutely positive that we're going to see some very interesting and active litigation surrounding the prosecution's requirement to provide Brady material, because I hear it from prosecutors all over the place. Even within the past 2 years, the amount of electronic information that they deal with and therefore we deal with has grown exponentially. And part of their way of dealing with this is reverting to the old method of providing discovery. They just give us what they think we need.
Right, because who gets to make the decision about what's quote-unquote exculpatory or helpful to the defense? Well, coincidentally, it happens to be the prosecutor gets to make the decision about what's most helpful to the defense. You know,
if they're wrong, the conviction gets reversed.
I think there should be a committee meeting before every charging decision where you and I get to say, okay, show it all to me, then I will tell you if it's helpful or not, and then if I think it's not helpful, then you can keep it, okay? What do you think?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm going to propose that.
Or, you know, boy, I don't know. I mean, we're going to have to do something to reinvent how this process works, because the old method is not going to work for very much longer. I mean, what's been happening to me so far is that the judge has to get involved, and judges don't like that, in discovery. You know,
right. No, they hate that.
As far as they hate that. And then prosecutors.
Okay, this is a whole new
show
right here.
Yeah, I've heard it is. It's an entirely different show. But I've heard it said many times by prosecutors. They don't look at everything until, you know,
right. They look
right
at
before it goes.
They
to
look
trial.
At just enough to get charged, and you know, and I've had on the eve of trial, they'll sit down and finally talk to their witnesses and say,
"Yep,
what was no? This is I just read the reports. I should have talked to you know, and
that's
they dismiss
tragic.
The case, and that you know, that's after 2 years of work.
Right, exactly.
All
right, that's all the time we have. So, hope you've enjoyed the show. You can tune in next Saturday, as you can every Saturday from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, right here on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL. Have a great weekend, everyone.